Hi, I'm Dick Daso, the Executive Director for the Air Force Historical Foundation. For the past 2 years, we've hosted book club and war stories events. The book club, hosted by Pepe Soto and his technical team, examined individuals and events, from Jimmy Doolittle and Hap Arnold to events of the Vietnam War. War Stories, hosted by Matt Jolly, focused on the American exit from Vietnam some 50 years ago. The Foundation is pleased to announce that it will release these interviews as podcasts through the rest of 2024. We hope that you enjoy the breadth and depth of coverage, and stay tuned for more from the AFHF. Enjoy this episode. Like, subscribe, and pass the links along to your cohort.
Got a couple seconds. Good evening, Pepe Soto here from the DC area. Welcome to tonight's book club version on our book series on the Vietnam War tonight. We have Dr. Mark Claude Foucher's awesome book, The Limits of Air Power, one of the hallmark books of your Air Force officers probably read in your career. And we're looking to have Dr. Claude Foucher here with us. And I now introduce the CEO of the Air Force Historical Foundation, General Mobile Holmes. Over to you, sir.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Pepe. Hi, everybody. Good evening and welcome to our next round of our book club. As you know, this year's book club sessions are focused on Vietnam. And what could be better than one of the best known looks at air power in the conflict in Vietnam? We're really happy to have with us Dr. Mark Claudefelter. Dr. Claudefelter is a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy. He did a couple of tours as a radar controller in the Air Force and then started down a journey as a historian and teacher. A couple of tours teaching at the Air Force Academy. He was an instructor at the School for Advanced Air Power Studies. I was one of his disappointing class three students, but took an awful lot from that class. He finished his career as the PAS, I believe, at the University of North Carolina's ROTC detachment. And two of his great loves are the United States Air Force, its academy, and the University of North Carolina. We're going to talk about his book on the limits of air power in Vietnam. But you can also find one of his, I don't know if it's his latest work, but it's his latest published, I think, a novel that's published on Air University Press. You can download it called Between Two Shades of Blue, which is about the Air Force Academy and a University of North Carolina basketball team and the effect they had on a student there. He spent many years teaching at the National War College, was a revered instructor there, retired, and was given the title Professor Emeritus at the National War College. We're extremely fortunate to have him here with us. Thank you, Claude, personally, for taking the time to join us. And Pepe, over to you and Dr. Claudefelter.
Okay, Claude, the stage is yours, sir. Over to you, sir.
Thanks, Pepe, and thanks very much, General. Let me say up front, I'm a class of 1977 graduate from the Air Force Academy, so obviously I did not serve in Vietnam. In fact, I don't remember much about the war as I was growing up and was a high school student, a junior high and high school student while it was going on. I can remember when Nixon mined Haiphong Harbor in May of 1972. I was a junior in high school. And believe it or not, the only thing I remember from December 1972, when Nixon did his great linebacker two bombing offensive there around Christmas, the only thing I remember about the month of December 1972 was in that month, I received an appointment to the Air Force Academy. So you may well be wondering what caused me to write what ultimately became The Limits of Air Power. Well, several factors at work. First of all, my dad, he was a corporal in the 20th Air Force in World War II. He was stationed there at Tinian when the Enola Gay made that fateful mission on Hiroshima. And he told me all about what it was like to be in the Pacific, but more importantly, I guess, he made sure I saw all of the strategic bombing movies from World War II as I was growing up. So, of course, I saw 12 O'Clock High, Command Decision, The War Lover. If it was about B-17s or B-29s, believe me, I saw it. And then when I got to the Air Force Academy there in 1973, all of the instructors there were military at that point in time. And virtually all of them had wings over their left pocket. And those that did had all flown in Vietnam. And almost to a man, they told me, they said, you know, if Lyndon Johnson had turned us loose the way Richard Nixon turned us loose there for 2 weeks in December 1972, we would have ended that war in no time flat. And I thought, well, gosh, these guys were there. They flew the missions. They should know. And then when I got out in the real Air Force there, after I graduated in 77, I was a weapons controller, GCI, and all of the, not all, but most of the pilots I was controlling there had also flown in Vietnam. They told me the same thing. If Johnson had done what Nixon did in 72 and 65, war would have been over in a heartbeat. And I thought, gosh, well, again, these guys were there. They should know. But the spark that really got me going was when I went to Korea in 1980 as a lieutenant, first lieutenant now, and my boss was a Major John Allen, and he had flown three B-52 missions over Hanoi during Linebacker 2. And needless to say, he told me stories of what it was like. He was up there the night of December 20th when we lost six B-52s shot down and two heavily damaged. And he said, you know, we were going in a stream 1 mile between aircraft and 3 miles between cells, and we're all going in straight line, same altitude, same airspeed. And he goes, yeah, we were terrified, just absolutely terrified. And he said, all of a sudden, about 7 or 8 miles ahead of him was an enormous explosion, and a B-52 had taken a SAM hit in a bomb bay. And he said that was the only time during Linebacker 2 when there was absolutely no radio or intercom communication for 30 solid seconds as everybody who could watch that enormous bomber spiral down to Earth. He was also up there on the 26th of December. And that's when we put 120 B-52s over Hanoi and Haiphong in a 15-minute time span, attacking from seven different directions, very different from what had occurred there at the start of Linebacker. And then he was up there on the last day, the 29th of December. And for most of the Linebacker missions, particularly those there at the very beginning and those there at the end, we would attack in three waves. And you'd have a wave that attacked at 7 p.m. local time, another at midnight, and another at 5 a.m. And he said, we were up there on the 5 a.m. mission. And he said, it was just beginning to be a little bit of light outside, and you could look out and you saw thousands of people evacuating Hanoi. He said, they were just getting the heck out. And he said, and at that point, it was easy pickings. The North Vietnamese had shot up all their SAMs, or shot off all their SAMs, and they had zero left. No losses the next to last day and the last day of Linebacker 2, none. And he said, so there we were. We had the North Vietnamese on the ropes, and Nixon made us stop. He goes, hey, Clyde, you were the history major. Why did Nixon do that? Why did he make us stop when he had them on the ropes? And I thought, well, that was a good question, but I didn't have the answer. And I said, sir, I don't know. But when I got to grad school a few years later, I decided to make that my mission, try and answer John Allen's question, not just from the standpoint of why we stopped there when we did in Linebacker 2, but also to examine the entire air war against North Vietnam and how it was conducted and how successful that air war was. And so when I got to grad school at the University of North Carolina, I was a very diligent grad student. I tried to look at as many primary sources as I could. I went to the National Archives, Library of Congress, spent 3 weeks at the Air Force Archives there at Maxwell, looked at all sorts of documents, but I also did quite a few interviews. I got 10 minutes on the phone with Robert McNamara, who refused to see me in person and said he would only give me 10 minutes. In contrast, I got 2 hours with former Secretary of State Dean Rusk there at his law office in Athens, Georgia. He was a law professor at the University of Georgia after he left Secretary of State. And he, like I said, he gave me 2 hours. Walt Rostow, National Security Advisor, gave me at least an hour. And interviewed a lot of generals and admirals. General Vogt gave me, I'd say, a good 2 hours. And then the interviews that meant the most to me were those that had been on the pointy edge of the spear, the pilots and the navigators that had flown the missions. And they gave me plenty, plenty of great information. And thus, when I finally finished the dissertation there in the spring of 1987, I was feeling pretty good about what I had accomplished. I thought, I have a non-parochial, non-biased, very direct, informative analysis of Rolling Thunder and the two linebackers. And this is really, really good stuff. And that's the attitude I had when I went into my dissertation defense. I thought to myself, you know, I'm an Air Force officer. I know this stuff. These six guys sitting around the table, professors sitting around the table from me, what do they truly know? I mean, these guys are, face it, they're geeks. So what do they know that I don't? And that was the attitude I had as the questioning began, going around the table. One person would ask a question and then the next and the next. First 15 minutes, man, I am feeling so good. It's like fastballs down the middle. Boom, 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 boom. I'm nailing everything. I feel it. It's great. And then the time came for Dr. Peter Walker to ask a question. He was Carolina's expert on the Civil War and Reconstruction. I'd taken his class and I really liked the way he thought, or at least up until that point in my life, I thought that I did. Now, Walker was from Mississippi. He had a horrible Southern accent. This is what he said. He said, "Captain Klodfelter, I've only got one question for you, and it is hypothetical." I thought to myself, all right, that's fine. He said, "Let's suppose you were Lyndon Johnson there in the mid-1960s, and you decided you were going to use air power in Vietnam, and you could only select one type of aircraft. What would it be?" Now, granted, this was not a question I had anticipated. But then I thought to myself, I go, this is perfect. This is ideal. Here is the chance for me to show just how much I know, how little you guys know, and show that I am not biased, not parochial. No, no. So I said, "Dr. Walker, I would choose the Navy A6 Intruder. Night, precision, all-weather bombing capability. I would pick the Navy A6. And he leaned back in his chair and he goes, "You would you?" Right then I'm thinking, oh God, danger, danger, Will Robinson, danger. And he leaned forward on the table, looked at me and said, "Son, have you ever heard of a helicopter?" I'm like, oh God in heaven. No, I wasn't parochial. I wasn't biased. Aircraft equals fixed wing equals jet. Something really snazzy. Oh God. Think about fighting the Vietnam War without helicopters. Absolutely crucial to moving men and firepower across the battlefields of South Vietnam. And that is where the war is going to be won or lost. But no, no. I went with the normal Air Force mindset. Aircraft equals fixed wing equals jet. Yeah, yeah. I shrunk to about 3 inches in my seat, turned fire truck red. And let's just say that the next 2.5 hours of my dissertation defense were not as fun as the first 15 minutes have been. All right. Did I lose you guys?
No, Clyde, we're just, you know.
Okay, I don't see anything on the Zoom, so I was just wondering. But anyhow, I wanted to give that background because that was my motivation. And I will say, when I went into the dissertation, which ultimately becomes Limits of Air Power, my fundamental premise going in was if we had done it the way Nixon did it in the spring of 65, we would have ended the war in, I don't know, maybe 2 months max. But that was my fundamental premise going in. Needless to say, that premise changed. I'm happy to take any questions that anybody's got, and I imagine people have a few.
Well, Clyde, I'll start out first, Clyde. And I call them blockers, we're good friends, but okay, Mal, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, Bobby Oates does have a question for you if he'd like to ask the question himself.
Herself.
Yeah, as I was reading, I was wondering if now, have you thought about re-looking at the book because it was done in 1989, now that more material's been declassified, if that would have changed anything?
It's a good question. The paperback edition then came out in 2006, and I did a little bit more research for that. But I've continued to research the air war in Vietnam, different aspects of it. I got a sabbatical in... I actually got two sabbaticals when I was teaching at War College. The second came from 2015 to 2016. And when I did that, I did two monographs, one looking at General Lavelle and his firing and loss of 2 stars there when he was commanding 7th Air Force in 1972. And the other was a study with B-52 crew members. I got surveys done from 85 of them, and I was examining how they dealt with Clausewitz's notion of friction, which he says is endemic to every war, uncertainty, chance, danger, and exertion, and how they dealt with those, whether they were bombing the South or bombing the North. And in doing both of those studies, I looked at quite a bit of classified information, much of which I got declassified, and I was very pleased by that. But everything I saw during that year span, dealing with Vietnam that had not been classified or that had not been declassified before, it didn't change any of my views regarding what I had originally written back in 1989.
Thank you.
Sure.
So Claude, I like the way you broke down the use of air power to 3 distinct air campaigns, Rolling Thunder, Linebacker, and Linebacker 2. In one of your lectures out about the book, you go into a much deeper breakdown of the air wars into 6 air wars in South Vietnam, Army, Marine, Air Force, Navy, Air Force bombers, Air Force fighters, the South Vietnamese Air Force, and 3 outside of the South, Laos, Cambodia, and North Vietnam. First question is, can you elaborate on how you came to this breakdown, which I like very much, by the way?
Yeah, obviously, I wasn't focused on the war in the South when I did Limits of Air Power, but I thought in terms of talking about the entire war, you gotta mention the air war in the South, or I should say the six air wars that you just mentioned, Pepe, because face it, this is staggering to me, even though I've come across these stats time and time again. We drop 1 million tons of bombs on North Vietnam. We drop 3 million tons of bombs on Laos and Cambodia. We drop 4 million tons of bombs on the country of our ally, that is South Vietnam. So I thought it was important to look at the disparate air wars that are going on over the South and how they resembled in many respects the air wars that were going on over the North. And the biggest resemblance is no unity of command, no one single air commander. And that's just so disappointing in terms of the way the war was waged and the outcomes that you could get. I mean, both in terms of the North and the South, B-52s were off limits to your 7th Air Force commander. He could not touch those puppies. They were directed, of course, initially by the Joint Chiefs of Staff because they were part of the nuclear triad. Ultimately, their control went down to PACOM, your Pacific Command commander. And then ultimately, he allowed the MACV commander, Military Assistance Command Vietnam commander, either William Westmoreland there at the start or Creighton Abrams, both of whom were Army generals, to control that, which they did. But you never had B-52s being controlled by anybody who was in theater, in terms of being in theater wearing Air Force blue. That just never happened. And so to me, that was the most disappointing. Obviously, the Marines there that had the air power, they were controlling in what was known as I Corps, the area just south of the DMZ. They were controlling their fighters and helicopters to protect their infantry, as you would expect. What else would you do? The Navy would provide the Marines with air support, and on occasion, they would provide the Army too. That was the Navy that was down in Dixie Station, and that was down in the South China Sea. But then you had another naval presence up at the Gulf of Tonkin, and those guys were focused on Rolling Thunder first, linebackers second, and that was their job was to bomb the North. But their coordination with the Air Force was absolutely minimal, totally and completely. And that's sad because you've got two services that are committing all sorts of manpower and materiel to attack targets in the North. And this is part of the book I didn't elaborate on. I mentioned it in Limits of Air Power, but let me just say, here's the saddest part about the Air Force and the Navy going against the North. It becomes a competition. Granted, tons of political controls on the bombing for both the Air Force and the Navy. I mean, there are controls that were coming out of the White House, needless to say, during Rolling Thunder, and to some degree, even coming out of the White House during Linebacker, not as much for sure. But what you did was the Pacific Command commander, U.S. Grant Sharp, Admiral, and in the spring of 1966, given that it was very difficult to show progress in a war that was seemingly endless, where we were bombing and the results were just minimal, he divided North Vietnamese airspace up into seven different bombing zones that he called route packages. And ostensibly, he did that because so many aircraft were flying over North Vietnam, you didn't want to have a midair, ostensibly. Well, he divided the heartland of North Vietnam into two zones. It was Route Pack 5A and 5B. And then you also had the Air Force had two zones in the northern North Vietnam. The Navy had one, the Navy had Haiphong, the Air Force had Hanoi. And with no real ability to demonstrate progress, progress became the number of sorties that were flown over North Vietnamese airspace. And you got a competition to do that. In the summer of 1967, Spike Momeyer was your 7th Air Force commander. And he used to ask to see, for his daily stand-up at 0600 every morning, he asked to see two slides that showed flying activity over North Vietnam the previous day. The first slide said sortie total over North Vietnam Navy. And the second total said sortie total over North Vietnam Air Force. And if the second slide didn't have a higher total than the first, heads rolled. I actually talked to a Navy A4 pilot who told me that he went out to do the walk around. His mission was the Tan Hoi Bridge, which was the toughest target in North Vietnam, the Dragon's Jaw, as it was known. It was attacked with 700 sorties and never knocked down during Rolling Thunder, 700 sorties. Well, his mission was the Tan Ha Bridge, and he went out to do the walk around of his A4. He looks under the aircraft and there's no bombs. So he goes up to his crew chief and goes, "Hey, you know, you guys are usually very good, but somehow today you forgot to put bombs on my aircraft." And crew chief looks at his clipboard and goes, "No, I'm sorry, sir. I don't know anything about what you're going to be attacking, but we don't have bombs for your aircraft today." He goes, "You're kidding." Crew chief goes, "No." He goes, the pilot goes running into the tower, tracks down the CAG, and he goes, "Sir, what's my target for today?" And the CAG says, "It's the Tan Hoa Bridge." He says, "Sir, do you realize that there's no bombs for my aircraft?" The CAG goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Sir, what am I supposed to do?" He goes, "When you get there, strafe it." He said, "So I took off, drive the catapult launch, made it over the target area, and I fired my 20 millimeter cannon up and down the span of the Tan Hoa Bridge, but it was kind of like shooting a BB gun at a wrought iron fence. Came back, landed, and as a result of what I did, the Navy sortie total increased by one." You had the Air Force doing the same thing. I used to ask my students there in my air power class at National War College, I said, "Suppose you were an F-4 squadron commander during this time. And by the way, there was a bomb shortage too, because we had used up all our conventional ordnance there in the first year and a half of Rolling Thunder, thinking that, you know, gosh, we're never going to do that again. So we had to go back to our NATO allies and ask them if they would sell us the surplus bombs we had sold them for $1.50 a piece at the end of World War II and Korea. And they said, sure. And they sold them back to us at $21.50 each, slight markup. But there's a bomb shortage there. And I used to ask my students, I said, suppose you're an F-4 squadron commander and you're going to attack the Tan Hoa Bridge. I said, how many aircraft are you going to send? And you've got 32 500-pound bombs to attack it. How many aircraft are you going to send? Oftentimes, they would say, after hearing the story, they would say 32. And I said, no, about the only thing I remember from my physics and aero classes at the academy was it would be better if you had a bomb under each wing for aerodynamic stability purposes. So now, how many are you going to send? And they would, of course, say 16. I go, that's right. And you may well get a promotion out of this, because you may have the highest sortie total in 7th Air Force there in Southeast Asia. Just utterly bizarre. Competition, no unity of command, just a violation of one of the fundamental tenets of war, unity of command. Never had it. Not in the South, not in the North, nowhere.
Excuse me, sir, I have a question. I'm Mike Brazelton. I was a F-105 pilot in the first half of 66, flying out of Tuxley. I flew a total of 111 missions. I was unfortunate enough to be shot down on my 111th and spent most of the war as a POW. But when I got there, I was surprised that some of my first missions, and I'm talking about now 4 105s in a flight, each loaded with 650-pound bombs. We were fragged against targets such as 10-foot wide, 30-foot long, underwater causeways, road cuts, suspected truck parks, things that really the 105 should never have gone against. However, I'm curious, had the tactical airplanes of both the Navy and the Air Force in 66 been allowed to go against the high-value targets, the steel mill, the railroad yards, the oil, what would have been the difference in those early years?
Well, based on the research that I did, unfortunately, not much. You're right. There was one steel mill, one cement factory, 8 thermal power plants in all of North Vietnam. We actually bombed the oil storage facilities there in Haiphong beginning in June 1966, and we kept that up for about 2 weeks straight. Destroyed a fair amount of oil, but the great problem was that the fundamental premise of Rolling Thunder was that the Viet Cong could not fight without the support and direction of the North Vietnamese. We thought that that was absolutely paramount for the Viet Cong to keep fighting. On the eve of the Tet Offensive there in August of 1967, our intelligence, which was not bad, we determined that there was 250,000 Viet Cong in the South and 50,000 in VA. Here's the problem. How often did they fight during this part of the war, the Rolling Thunder part? They fought an average of 1 day out of 30. Now that they fought certainly more than that during the Tet Offensive or the Siege of Khe Sanh or Con Thien or something like that. But for most of the Rolling Thunder period, 1 day out of 30. Get these stats. In 1967 and 1968, which were the years of peak combat activity for America and Vietnam, all of the Army and Marine patrols we sent out to make contact with the enemy on so-called search and destroy missions, 1% did. 1% of all of those we sent out during that 2-year span. When you add in the ARVN troops, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, the South Vietnamese, that total drops to 0.1%. They control the vertical, they control the horizontal, and they only fought when they thought it would be advantageous for them to do so. And thus, even though we're blowing away immense numbers of supplies there on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and we're hitting high-value targets in North Vietnam, which we were by 1967, we blow away the cement factory, the steel mill, and take out quite a few of the thermal power plants. It made no difference because the character of the war was so infrequent. Now, that does not mean by any stretch of the imagination that Americans didn't die during that two-year span. In 1967, we lost 10,000 Americans dead. In 1968, we lost 15,000 dead. One-fourth of those, 6,000, were killed by mines and booby traps. They controlled the vertical and the horizontal. They did not need that immense amount of supplies that we thought they did. So the fundamental premise that they needed America's, or that they needed the North's resupply was simply flawed. And if you look at the other part of the equation, did they need the North's direction of the war? No. Many of your Viet Cong fought because they hated the regimes in South Vietnam. I used to tell my students, pick your favorite South Vietnamese leader, Diem, Con, Ky, Chu, all paragons of virtue, just great, great people. They were horribly corrupt, totally out of touch, and hell, they were a Catholic in a predominantly Buddhist country. So many of the Viet Cong fought because they hated that leadership. They just hated it. One of the books I read that I thought was incredibly insightful, it's called A Viet Cong Memoir, written by Phuong Nhu Thong, who was their Viet Cong Minister of Justice. He said, we wanted the Saigon government out. That was their first objective. And the second objective was they wanted Americans out. And you got to ask yourself, well, why in God's name did we support such a fundamentally corrupt, out of touch population? And here's the kicker, because they were not commies. They were not good people, but they were not commies. And at that point in time, communism was the great evil, the great enemy. And we were definitely going to oppose a communist regime that was supporting the Viet Cong in the South. But man, the VC didn't need it. Now, after the Tet Offensive, when they do fight pretty much conventional war with us and they come out of hiding, and so too does the NVA for that matter, American firepower blows them away. So for the remainder of the war there, from 1969 on till 1973, you're not going to have a large amount of Viet Cong conducting the fight. In fact, the NVA is hurt so badly that they revert, much like the Viet Cong that is left, and there's not many of them, to fighting a guerrilla conflict that's waged very infrequently, back to one day out of 30. And not until 1972, when the North Vietnamese Army has licked its wounds in the aftermath of Tet and built up and got a tremendous resupply from the Soviets with T-54 tanks and 130-millimeter artillery when they come south for the Easter Offensive, well, then it's an entirely different type of war. And the targets we hit during Rolling Thunder, which are much the same targets that we hit during Linebacker, they have telling effect, because the character of war has now changed from a predominantly guerrilla conflict to a conventional type. I mean, what the NVA does in the spring of 72 is very similar to what the Germans did in the Blitzkrieg there in May of 1940 against France, except they don't have the air power. But they've certainly got the armor, and they've certainly got the artillery, and they've got 120,000 well-trained troops that are just marching through the South Vietnamese in very fast fashion. So sorry for the long-winded answer, but that's my take on why it would not have helped. And I will also say, you hit the high-value targets there. You do what the air commanders from both Air Force and Navy wanted to do there in the spring of 1965. You go in, you do that in a six-week air campaign that takes out the cement factory, the steel plant, the thermal power, all that. What does that do for you? Does that cause Ho Chi Minh and his leadership to throw in the towel and go, okay, we quit? And we thought that it would. We really did. The air commanders especially thought that it would, because if you just go back a few years to October 1962, where we used the threat of American air power to make the Soviet Union back down during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And now you're talking Ho Chi Minh in North Vietnam, which Lyndon Johnson in his great eloquence said, that's a fourth-rate pissant country that is never going to be able to stand up to us. Well, if you have that mentality, maybe you think that such a sudden hard knock is going to cause them to throw in the towel. But after fighting the French for, oh God, so many years, beginning in 1947 all the way through 54, and then continuing to consolidate, I don't see them backing down. I really don't. And so, could be wrong. It's a counterfactual, it's a hypothetical. Would it have caused Ho Chi Minh to throw in the towel? And that's just it. If he had thrown in the towel, I say, so what? Take away the 50,000 NVA there in August of 1967. You still got 250,000 VC that are fighting a great guerrilla war that we don't have an answer to. And thus, bombing the North to win in the South, we thought it would work, but our fundamental premise that the Viet Cong needed North Vietnamese support and direction was fundamentally flawed, in my opinion.
Okay, we got some more questions from the field. So Mel, you want to grab those?
All right, Claude, we have a question from Mr. Daryl Whitcomb first, and then we have a few after his question as well. Mr. Whitcomb, if you'd like to ask the question.
Okay. Yeah, Mark, good to see you again. And I'm going to shift gears on you. Let's talk about General Lavelle and work that you did on that, basically to lead us to the point where I think he deserves exoneration for his for what everything that happened to him in the 1972 period, when I was there incidentally bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And it was full of enemy trucks then too.
Yeah, it's a sad tale about Lavelle. He did exactly what he was told to do. The documentation is there. It's very evident. You've got tapes that were declassified of discussions between Nixon and Kissinger in 2002 and 2003. And since then, you've got documentary evidence that shows he was thrown under the bus for doing exactly what Nixon had ordered him to do. And yet, why that has not changed is honestly beyond me. The Senate Armed Services Committee received a request from President Obama in 2009 to restore his two stars and to make him a general in his retirement. And that was when Carl Levin was the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and the ranking member was Senator McCain. And they decided that that was not appropriate because more research needed to be done before they could endorse that. And the members of the Senate provided a list of 10 or 11 different points that they thought needed more research and more explanation. And one thing I did when I got on sabbatical there at War College in 2015 was I thought, okay, all right, they say this. I'm going to take each point by point, and see if I can come to any conclusions. And I did that and spent, oh God, 6 months at the National Archives, as well as doing all sorts of other stuff. And the more I dug, the more I was absolutely convinced that Lavelle was innocent. And here's the saddest part, Daryl, in this case. I guess in my Air Force career, I was somewhat naive, and I believe that, you know, if you get to be a four-star admiral or general, you're a pretty stand-up guy, and you're a decent individual with honesty and integrity. Here's what I found out. Three general officers that testified at the Lavelle, at Lavelle's hearing there in 1972. That would be John Ryan, the Air Force Chief of Staff. That would be Thomas Moore, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Brayton Abrams, the Army four-star general that came after Westmoreland, did not tell the truth regarding Lavelle. And I found the documents that showed it crystal clearly. And to me, that was the most disappointing part of my finding, was that you had three four stars. And again, there was rationale. General Ryan wanted to retire without any stain on his record as the Air Force Chief of Staff, which he thought this, you know, and he was just saying that Lavelle was a bad apple that didn't do what he was supposed to do. Moore wanted to be picked again by Nixon to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs for another 2-year term. And Creighton Abrams wanted to be, after he had left Vietnam, he wanted to be Army Chief of Staff. He became that. Moore got picked for another 2 terms. Ryan went on and retired. And here's the part of it too. One thing that you asked me, Pepe, was and I alluded to it there at the start. What was so wrong in Vietnam? So many things were wrong in Vietnam. The question is, what was right in Vietnam? I can't come up with much of that. But so many things were wrong. You had no unity of command. And you asked, did that help lead to the Joint Forces Air Component Commander today? Yeah, in no uncertain terms, it certainly did. And here's something else it did. It spurred Goldwater Nichols. And one thing that Goldwater Nichols did was it took the chairman out of the chain of command, operational command. And at the time of Vietnam, Jack Ryan, the Air Force Chief of Staff, was also in the operational chain of command. So you had Ryan telling Lavelle stuff, you had Moore telling Lavelle stuff, and then their memory would either be selective, they couldn't remember exactly what was said, or they just flat out lied when they got on the stand there to the Senate. And again, that all of that combined, particularly with the point of no unity of command with 6 different air wars over the South, 3 over the North, and then this as well, where you get interference from the chairman or your service chief on an almost daily basis, if you're like the 7th Air Force commander. That's why we have a Joint Forces Air Component Commander today. And thank God we do, because the system we had in Vietnam was just broken from the get-go.
Next question, Mel.
All right, we'll go ahead and move with Mike Devine, please. And if Mr. Devine doesn't have audio, or I can go ahead and read his question. Stay away. Go ahead.
But, if you can hear me now. Sir, given that your thesis in Limits of Air Power was certainly unpopular with many USAF leaders back in 1989, did you ever feel that authoring the book hurt your career?
Short answer is no, but Let me provide a caveat. General Holmes will appreciate this story. So I leave the Air Force Academy there, where I'd been the director of military history. And I go down to Maxwell Air Force Base, which is starting up its new school of advanced air and space studies. And I get down there, and this was in, oddly enough, this was in January of 1991, right after Desert Storm had begun. This is like maybe 2 weeks into Desert Storm. So I get down there and I check in, and we have an 06 that's in charge of the school, Fraser Fortner, great guy. And after I got all squared in, checked in, you know, and taken care of, you know, and was getting ready to start to actually produce something that might be useful for the class that was coming in the following summer, he calls me into his office, the head of SAS, and he says, I will leave the three-star general's name out of the story. He goes, do you know General so-and-so? And I said, well, sir, I certainly know of him, and I may have chatted with him once or twice, but no, I really don't know him. He goes, well, how do you explain this? Pulls out an envelope from behind his desk, and it's got a copy of The Limits of Air Power in it, and then it's got a note. And the note was written to the Air University commander, and it said, do you really want somebody who has written this book teaching at your nifty new school? Signed, the general, the three-star. And he shows this to me, and he goes, you got any explanation for this? I said, no, sir, I don't. And he goes, well, the Air University commander just wanted me to pass this down your way. And so I'm fulfilling what he wanted me to do. I said, okay, sir. I was extremely fortunate that the Air University commander was, he had been, the POW that's on here probably served with him because he had been.
Was it General Boyd?
Yes, it was Chuck Boyd. Yes. Yeah. And, Boyd later came to me and said, well, I just wanted to see you to see that you might have critics out there and be aware of that. So that was, yeah. And General Boyd was, the whole time I was at SAS, he was a huge supporter. And I thought he was a great Air University commander. And I was thrilled when he got his fourth star and went to Europe. So, oh, by the way, speaking of which, Daryl, back to what you said about Lavelle, I drew up a list. I had retired generals. I had 43 of them, and they all endorsed. They all signed, saying that General Lavelle should get his two stars back. And Chuck Boyd was one of the, I had 13 four-star, all of these generals were retired. Nobody on active duty, they were all retired. But I had 13 four-stars, and General Boyd was one of those that signed. And I thought that was powerful, and I thought that might help. And it ultimately did help, I think, because it went to, I'm trying to remember the, when General Goldfein was chief, our Heather Wilson, she got the list, and so did Goldfein, and they both pushed it up to, that was at the time, to General Mattis. But then General Mattis retired before anything could be done with it. So it didn't come to fruition that way. And then what I've been told is every time they have a different chairman or a different Air Force secretary, the whole process is being restarted over and over. It's like, good grief, guys. What's it going to take? But anyhow, General Boyd was a great supporter. And if you knew him in the Hanoi Hilton, I'm sure you knew a great man.
Well, Mark, I just have to say that for those of us who remember that war and fought in that war, we are aware of your work and what you laid out for us. And I guess you could say now we know the rest of the story. We know the true story, and we thank you for your work. Top notch, buddy.
Thanks, Daryl.
Good, Mel.
All right, we'll go to Mr. Bill Strandberg's question, please.
Yes, sir. I actually had one concerning if President Johnson was very concerned about the Chinese coming across the border and we didn't go north. But from a history standpoint, very early on, I was always very impressed with General Kinney working with General MacArthur and Sutherland, using air power to support the Southeast Asia theater. And then later, of course, Admiral Halsey using the Army Operation Vengeance, the shoot down of Yamamoto. It appeared that the Army Air Force's support, especially there in the Southwest Pacific, worked much better with the different commanders and with the Navy than you've explained. Did we lose something between the end of World War II and becoming a separate service and Vietnam in terms of working and having senior aviation commanders who knew how to direct things and work with the theater commanders?
I would say in the Second World War, the reason it worked so well between MacArthur and Kinney was because they had a deep appreciation and respect for one another. I've heard this story. When Kinney was hired there, MacArthur didn't know much about him, and his staff, and you probably know this, MacArthur's staff was in many respects a group of sycophants who, they were skeptical of anybody who might usurp MacArthur's power there. So there was basically an interview, and Kinney showed up at MacArthur's headquarters, and of course he's got all his toadies there ringed around him. And and MacArthur says to Kinney, he goes, why should I have you as my air commander? And here's what Kinney does. He picks up a sheet of a white paper off of MacArthur's desk. And he goes, you see this sheet of paper? He puts a dot on it. And he says, this dot is how much the rest of you people in this room know about air power. And the rest of the white sheet of paper is how much I know. You let me do my job, and I think we'll get along just fine. And from that point on, MacArthur was, well, sir, their personalities were meshed. They were beautiful together. In Vietnam, because the war aims were so desperate, nobody... And again, that's one thing I tried to make clear in the book. If you ask what the definition of victory was in Vietnam, you would get 10 different answers, even if you were asking four-star generals or maybe even members of the Lyndon Johnson administration who were very high up the food chain, like McNamara, Russ, Rostow, all those guys. Again, no consistency. And thus, you created the... in many respects, the animosity, the service parochialism that's going to be natural anyhow, but you made it a fight to see who could do the most to achieve victory. John McConnell was the Air Force Chief of Staff there at the start during much of Rolling Thunder. And he stated, he goes, Two things. At the Battle of the Eye of Drang, he had his staff officers, high-level staff officers, monitor everything the Army did to show, to prove that the Army could not conduct air mobile operations without without having fixed-wing support from Air Force aircraft. And that was important to him. And then he stated in August of 1965, I see no real use for the B-52 in Vietnam, but I'll be damned if I'm going to have Westmoreland win this war with the Army alone. Well, there you go. So when you have the Air Force Chief of Staff saying that, God, you never felt like you were on the same team. And I'm not going to say that was not the case in World War II, because as you know, with MacArthur and Nimitz, there was no love lost in terms of their dual offensives across the Pacific there. You know, Nimitz would have told you all day long, the Marines were the ones that were going to do it right. And MacArthur would have said, no, it's the United States Army. So again, that can happen, but you never got the personalities melded together. And part of that was because what was coming out of the White House was so contradictory. And well, and this is back to the Lavelle affair, but you have Richard Nixon telling Admiral Moore, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, you do not talk at all to Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird. You got that? If you have a problem that you need fixed as chairman, you come to me in the White House. I don't want you talking to the Secretary of Defense. Well, now that's a great example for a four-star general who's the chairman to go, well, my Lord, who is in charge here? What civilian control do we have? Again, just situation horribly messed up. Again, yeah, Nixon's bombing works better, but that's only because the character of the war has changed, and it's a conventional conflict at that time. And Nixon's had the great diplomatic capability to take the Chinese and Russians out of the conflict with their emphasis on detente at that point in time. Again, something Johnson just simply was unable to do. But again, different situation.
Kamel.
All right, Dr. Klodfelter, we have time for one more question, so I'm going to send it out to Mr. Bingham. Okay, Dr. Klodfelter, we have time for one more question, so I'm going to go ahead and send it out to Dr. Bingham if he's available.
Well, it's not a doctor. Hey, Mark, good seeing you.
Good seeing you, Price.
My question, and it's a question that continues to a degree, but not as seriously as back in Vietnam. Why do you think our Air Force leadership did not demand honest criticism and questions from their subordinates? Our tactics frequently were flawed. You've already talked about we didn't have enough bombs, but we would order our people to fly sorties without a full load because it just, I saw it in my three tours, the lack, the fear of someone criticizing, they didn't demand from subordinates honest evaluations. It was fear of questioning anything. And even later on, I noticed in my career, we always say we want innovation, but if you say something or criticize a policy or program, they could land on you with both feet. They really didn't want people to say what they really thought. And I don't think you can have an effective military in which you don't have integrity from top to bottom and commanders that demand and evaluate their subordinates and they're willing to tell the truth. There was a Naval Institute Proceedings article that talked, I don't know if it was actually true, but supposedly a commander came in without having his original staff. And so he wanted to find out about his staff. So he had a draft order and asked him to evaluate this draft order. And the next day he questioned them what they thought of it. And he went around the room and they were, oh, this is great. This is what we needed to do. And only one person raised his hand and said, you know, I see these problems, and these problems. The commander said, thank you very much, walked out of the room. And it was his flag lieutenant who was the one that asked the questions. He called him in and said, thank you. That was a test for my staff. I wanted to find if they were willing to tell the truth. And I found the answer. And I don't know if any of how many commanders are willing to ask from their staff and give them that type of test. What do you think?
Oh, man. Yeah. Again, it's. I'll get back to my main man, and that's Clausewitz, who said the greatest type of courage. He goes, there's two types of courage. There's courage on the battlefield, you know, the type that most people can relate to. And he goes, that's important. You've got to have that. That's essential. He goes, but more important is moral courage, the ability to think through a difficult problem and to say, hey, this is not right. This is wrong. And perhaps be willing to sacrifice a career, you know, to do that. That is an incredibly hard thing to do. And yet you've absolutely got to have that if you're going to be a successful military. You've got to have the guys saying, hey, this is dorked up. Like after the first 3 days of linebacker two, stop it. You know, this is wrong. But so it's so easy when you've got all those parameters. And let me say this too, in the type conflicts you have in for most of Vietnam, you couldn't tell whether you were winning or losing because there were no lines on a map. You couldn't see where the enemy forces had been pushed back or taken hits or anything of that nature. And thus, you continued in many respects to do the same thing you had been doing because you didn't know what else to do. And you couldn't gauge results. And in those type of environments, that's where you get things like the route pack system, where you're going to have guys flying less missions because, and this is one, I've often thought, that one of the flaws of the Air Force is we are so technologically focused. We have to be. I mean, you got to be able to fight and live in a different medium, you know, so you've got to have the tech to do that. But it also leads to quantification of results. And there are, in most cases in warfare, you can't simply quantify results. You know, back to Clausewitz, he says an enemy's power of resistance is equal to two things, his capability times his will. Okay, you can plot out the capability, but how many times in a conflict can you take an enemy's capability to zero? Okay, so how do you know when you are truly affecting his will? And what does that cause you to do? And again, it's not quantifiable. And yet we have come up with, I remember seeing charts from Afghanistan where it was like how many sorties, again, it was right out of the Vietnam playbook. How many sorties had been flown each month in Afghanistan? And when a new commander came in, suddenly the sortie total jumped up and it's like, so what? Those guys, what does that mean? They were like the VC. They were not fighting all the time. And we flew more sorties. We may even have dropped more bombs. But dropping more bombs is no guarantee, especially if they're going to, well, again, now, let me perhaps bring it forward to the present. Now, Vietnam is easy compared to what commanders face now. Could you imagine Vietnam if you had this, where you were getting insight from God and everybody every day via this, whether they were a reporter or just a guy that happened to be on the street or something. Everybody's their own newsman now, and they're putting out stuff which may or may not be correct. And by the way, the other guys are doing it too. My God, the Russians and Chinese have fabulous websites that look wonderful that are totally bogus, completely bogus. So too did Al-Qaeda, ISIS, you name it. They're all good at this stuff. And what do you do against an enemy like that? And God, collateral damage? Oh, whether it's made or not, the other guys might blow something up themselves and say you did it. Well, that's, oh man, how do you deal with that? And we didn't have to deal with that type of stuff in Vietnam. And yet that war was incredibly confusing and often in disarray. And now you've got that. I used to tell my students at War College, compared to what you're going to face, Vietnam was straightforward. And that to me is the scariest part of all. Let me also say that one thing that I hope survives from the limits of air power is the notion I had of positive and negative political objectives. And again, I stole some of that from Clausewitz, although he used those terms not to talk about political objectives, but to talk about attack and defense. I say positive objectives can only be achieved by the application of military force. Negative objectives can only be achieved by the limitation of military force. In any limited war, you're going to have both. And in most cases, when you're a superpower involved in limited war, you're going to have a ton of negative objectives. I was thinking right now, and in fact, I plotted it out, what the Russians versus the Ukrainians have. And in terms of Ukrainian political objectives, it's to expel Russian forces from Ukraine, including parts of the country taken in 2014. Yep, they've got to use force to do that. But in the meantime, they've got to maintain Western support, particularly from the United States and NATO countries, and that limits what they can do. Whereas, on the other hand, the Russians have very few negative objectives. The only ones I could really come up with are to not use nukes, and also to demonstrate to avoid severe losses in manpower and equipment that makes them look bad on the world stage. Because I would say they also have the positive objective to apply air power against a perceived enemy to cower other adversaries. Again, that's just notions I have at the present time, trying to use the little matrix I created there to guide limits of air power. But I think that little framework still works in the modern day and is made infinitely tougher to achieve success by stuff like this.
Claude, thanks for those great words, especially tying in the current crisis and conflict with Vietnam. So Jonah Holmes, sir, over to you on that one.
Thank you, Pepe. Thanks to Jen and Mel and the people that helped put this on. Thanks to everybody for joining us. You know, several of those questions that we asked Dr. Claude Felter about, how do you prepare people? Why didn't people tell the truth? How do we, was he popular for the things that he wrote? You know, I would tell you that he helped prepare a generation of young airmen and officers from across the services at the War College to learn how to evaluate multiple opinions through multiple sources, to pull those together through analysis and form opinions and make plans. The three-week course on Vietnam that he taught when I was a student at SAS, we did exactly that. We read multiple viewpoints, not just his. We evaluated the views of others. We came to some opinions. And one of the most interesting things we did was we did an exercise of the very early days, I think it was like 1966, and we had to draw up what we would do with air power if we were the unified air component commander and how we would set that up. So Claude, you instilled that a desire and a hunger for doing that in a whole group of officers. We appreciate the impact you've had on the Air Force and all the services through your career at the War College. And thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, General.
In tonight's session, everybody, next month we have, or probably July, we have the next book being Max Boot's book, Road Not Taken, by Edward Lansdale, the guy who coined the phrase coin and probably top coin experts you ever heard about. So with that, thanks to our team, Claude, awesome session, sir, as usual, for bringing us all your knowledge to bear, especially the time with the current Ukraine crisis. You, as always, always enjoy my time with you, sir. So go Heels.
Always, Peppy. Thanks.
Right. Have a good night, everybody, and I'll see you in the green room, Claude. Thanks, everybody.